Good morning. Welcome everybody back to our Bible study here this morning at 36th Street. So as we can open up our Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 20, we will be studying in 1 Kings chapter 20. Dan, we have some people say they can't really hear me down here. So you'll have to be able to hear because I don't have a PowerPoint, so there's nothing to read. So if you would, go ahead and open your Bibles to 1 Kings 20 as we look through that. We've got about 30-some verses to go through, so we're probably not doing a whole lot of verse-by-verse readings as much as just kind of overviews. We'll probably touch on most of it anyway, but since it's God's Word and He put it there for us to read, we need to read it. On a personal note, ask you to please be praying for our family. My brother John passed away a few minutes ago. We put him on palliative care yesterday down at Charleston. So he's a whole lot better off in a better place right now than what he's been for the last 5 or 6 years. If you didn't know, he'd had multiple myeloma cancer that spread through his, from his brain around. It killed his kidneys from the protein, so he'd been on dialysis for over 5 years now. He's really struggled with a lot of different problems, different factors of it, but he finally got meningitis, which they couldn't treat without doing a serious operation, and his body just couldn't recover from the operation, so we didn't put him through that. So, like I say, we put him on palliative care yesterday afternoon. He passed away. He just got the word a few minutes ago. So we'll be probably leaving here early from service to head down that way to be with Cindy. But please keep her especially in your prayers. She's an only child, doesn't have any children of her own, so she's down there by herself. And her mom's in a nursing home with Alzheimer's. So some days she's there and some days she's not. So last week she asked if John's obituary was already in the paper because she wanted to see it, but that's kind of what Cindy's been going through. But so please keep them. I know I may sound kind of cold up here because we didn't take off and run, but we were down yesterday. We said our goodbyes. I talked to him earlier, knew his desires. He sang his DNR when he went in the hospital this time. He was an EMT for years. He had a better medical understanding than any of us in the family. He knew what was happening, what was going to happen, and what would happen if they tried to extend. And so he didn't want any of it. So we followed his wishes. We miss him, but we know he gave his life to Christ. He believed and was baptized. So we have that hope that he's in heaven and enjoying something so much better than we can even imagine. So, if you would please bow with me as we go to God in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, we do come to you this morning to worship you and to praise you and to learn more of you. Heavenly Father, this world is kind of tough. There's things that we can't control. There's hurts, there's problems, but Heavenly Father, that's what you told us in your word over and over and over again, that if we rely on you, our promise is our salvation through Jesus to be in heaven with you forever, to live with you forever, that this world is not our home. There's nothing here we have to treasure at all. The only thing we have here on this earth that's of any value is our friendship and our brotherhood in Jesus with all of our fellow Christians. As we worship together, as we work together, as we reach out to each other. Help us in this time, especially with my family. Help us always as we go through life to show others your love and the way we react to difficulties and the way we react to hurts and problems and the way that we react to out of love to others that are in need. Be with me this morning as we go through this chapter. Help us to glean a little bit of understanding of what you want us to know about how you treat those that worship you and believe in you and the way that you handle those who don't. Help us always remember this and be with us and all the rest of our congregation that's suffering at this time and going through difficulties. We ask this now in Jesus' name. Amen. How many were here Wednesday night for Dan Kessinger's lesson? All right. Great, wasn't it? If you weren't, I recommend you go online and watch it, either on YouTube or on Facebook, because I'm sitting back there listening to him teach my lesson this morning. Except he was teaching it about the Southern Kingdom and their fall, but everything that he was bringing out about the greatness of God and what Habakkuk was learning about God and his struggles, about how God treated people, and how great God is and the awesomeness of God, that you sit and let each of us keep silence and listen to God. That was the gist of his lesson. As we look at this lesson in 1 Kings 20, we're going to see kind of the same thing. A little different situation, but you know, we've been talking about Ahab here for, four chapters, because he started in chapter 16. We get introduced to Ahab, how bad his father was, and he comes in and makes it even worse. So we've been looking at Ahab for quite a few weeks here, and we still have another one to go. But Ahab is not a good guy. His father was bad, and Ahab was worse. He did everything he could to really displease God. All of his actions were evil. There was nothing good to say about him. But when we look at this chapter, some questions pop up. Why is God being so good to Ahab? Why is God protecting Ahab? And I think as we look at this, we're going to say, maybe that's not what the real story is here. So as we open this chapter, we've been looking at Elijah for the last few chapters and how his dealings with Ahab and all the, you know, and the having the altar and the fire come down from heaven and burn up, and you know, all the priests of Baal were, you know, killed, and Ahab didn't change. He runs home to Mama Jezebel, tells her what happens, and she's the one that takes over, right? Going to kill Elijah, and he, you know, some translations or some commentary says he's scared and runs off. But I've been looking through Kaufman as kind of my base for my study here. So if you hear things common and you're a Kaufman fan and read his commentary, you're going to hear it. But his idea is that, have you ever dealt with people that when you get to a point with them, you know there is nothing that's going to change their mind? They are so, you know, they're not going to change. There's no use arguing with them. There is nothing you could say that's going to change them at all. And what do? Does he keep beating your head against the wall? Or do you finally walk off and find somebody that you can reach and work with? And Kaufman kind of brings that out, is it sounds more like Elijah has come to that point. He went, he destroyed Baal's worship right there on that altar. He showed the whole Israel nation, you know, look what your God can do. Baal is nothing. And they still want to kill him. You know, Jezebel still, you can't change that attitude. So he says, I'm going to leave. I'm going to go to where it's protected a little bit more, down in Judea, all right? Be with the people that love God and do what I can and help them. So he's not running because he's scared. We see him in the cave. We see him just kind of distraught. But we don't see him anymore in this chapter, okay? And if you look at what he says, when God finally gets him out of the cave, he's crying to God. What's he start off with? It is enough. I've had it, right? I did my best. I did everything you told me to do. Nothing changed. I'm no better than my fathers were at trying to help these people. It's enough. So God gets another prophet ready to work with Ahab. God softens him up, Ahab. As we look at this chapter, we're going to see different battles with the Syrian king, Ben-Hadad, which is kind of a title, not a name, because there's a bunch of Ben-Hadads in the Old Testament, the different ones through Syria. But this is the one that's afflicting Ahab at the time. And we see in 1 Kings 20, verse 13, the reason God is doing this, he says it a couple times in this chapter, that Ahab shall know that I am Jehovah. What was Elijah trying to show Ahab? That God, the Lord, is Jehovah, right? It didn't work. So, as we start off chapter 20, it starts out with Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, gathered all of his army together. 32 kings were with him, and horses and chariots, and he went up and closed in on Samaria and fought against it. All right, Samaria, we're talking the city that Ahab's father built, bought and built, the fortress on the hill, okay? So Ben-Hadad comes down from Syria with this huge army and surrounds the city and besieges it, so it holds it in battle, traps them in. It doesn't seem like it's the Roman sieges when they'd come in and you actually built walls against the walls so they couldn't get out and completely surround. It seems like Ahab had a little bit of movement. He could get in and out of the cities. They could do different things. He could pull people in. So how much was just directly in the city, because it was huge, versus, he's pulling people around, and you see messengers going in and out. So I just don't want you thinking, that walled fort, the old wooden forts out west with the Indians running around it. This is not the siege we're talking about. This is a populous city, metropolitan city, that's got this huge army scattered around it fighting. How long were they in siege? Again, one verse could cover years. It doesn't give us an idea. Remember, Ahab was in power for 22 years. How much of that is this stretch here now? How long had he been tied up in this city with this army of Syrians around him? We don't know. But it's long enough that when Ben-Hadad sends in a threat or says, here's what I want you to do, Ahab jumps on it. So as we continue on, and he sent, this is Ben-Hadad, sent messengers into the city of Ahab, the king of Israel, and said to him, thus says Ben-Hadad, your silver and your gold are mine. Your best wives and children are also mine. And the king of Israel answered, as you say, my lord, O king, I am yours and all that I have. Ahab was a great military might, wasn't he? He was a great military leader. Seems like he crumples. He crumpled in front of his wife, Jezebel. He crumples in front of, this. First thing he does is says, okay, it's yours. So come and take it. But then Ben-Hadad thinks a little bit about what he just sent, and he says, then the messengers came again and said, thus says Ben-Hadad, I sent to you saying, deliver me your silver and your gold and your wives and your children. Not only is he going to take it, he wants it sent to him, right? Nevertheless, I will send my servants to you tomorrow about this time, and they shall search your house and the houses of your servants and lay hands on whatever pleases you, take it away. Now, we think in servants, and I kind of see that, and I say, the people in their house, right? He's talking about the people of the city, all the Israelites. All the army is going to come in and just destroy everything. They're going to take over this every house, they're going to search it, they're going to take what they want. Anything that looks good that anybody wants, they're going to take it. So before it was just give me your gold, king, and your stuff. Now it's everybody. I'm going to wipe out Israel, in other words. There won't be anything left that you find for it.
I always wondered, verse 3, what
So.
And where did Jezebel fall on?
Yep, you're jumping on my lesson here, so that's all right. So as we get, we'll be getting there, but as they're being defeated, and as this comes up, and Ahab's now in a predicament. So he goes to the elders. Finally, the king goes and talks to somebody else except for what's on top of him. You know, I'm no longer, these are all my servants. You get that? The kings are calling their people servants. Everybody in the nation of Israel was a servant of Ahab. And everybody in the Syrian army was a servant of Ben-Hadad. It's kind of like this threat of Ben-Hadad is kind of this, you need to surrender. Kind of sounds like what happened in 1945 to Japan, right? What was the command that the Allies sent to Japan?
Total surrender.
Unconditional surrender, or, remember the rest of it? Prompt and utter destruction. That's what was sent to Japan before they signed that. That's how it came across. Because what had just happened? Two atomic bombs just wiped out two cities. Japan didn't have anything left. So, this is kind of that same fear that Ahab's seeing. Complete, total surrender. And we'll see in a little bit that prompt and utter destruction coming. Do we see, though, from Ahab's point of view, what did he have to hope for? He didn't have an army. He'd been besieged. He doesn't have anything to fight with. His god Baal is turned against him, right? Because Elijah proved it. He's nothing. So he's lost faith in all of Baal. And one thing I found interesting is the Ben-Hadad. You know what Hadad's for? Ben is what in Hebrew? Son of. Hadad was the storm god. And who is the storm god?
Baal.
So the children of Baal are fighting the children that are worshiping Baal that shouldn't be. So how can you call against the God, you know, and expect Baal to do anything, even if he could, which we proved he can't. So that's where Ahab's at. You know, he doesn't have any. And is God going to come to his defense? Because he didn't turn to God when Elijah showed him. So who does he got to turn to? It's kind of what we need to look at in this situation that he's in. One thing Kaufman kind of brought out was, if God is not allowed to rule over us, then our enemies shall command us. A rebel to God is a slave to everything else. I'm sure he pulled that quote from somebody, because Kaufman's always good at using that. But do we really understand that? If we don't turn ourselves over to God, everything else evil is going to be commanding us to do what to do. If you want to rebel against God, you're going to be a slave to everything else. So then the king of Israel called all the elders of the land and said, "Mark, I pray you, and see how this man seeketh mischief." That's kind of a mischief? He's going to kill you. For he sent them to me for my wives and for my children, for my silver and my gold, and I denied him not. And all the elders and all the people said to him, hearken thou not, neither consent. Wherefore he said unto the messengers of Ben-Hadad, tell my lord the king, still with my lord, tell my lord my king, that all that thou didst send for thy servant at first I will do, but this thing I may not do, that you could come into the city and just pillage it. And the messengers departed and brought to him word again. And Ben-Hadad sent word unto him and said, the gods do so to me, and more so if the dust of Samaria shall suffice for handfuls of all the people that follow me. Prompt and utter destruction. There's not going to be enough dirt left of Samaria that my soldiers that are numerous, because we're going to see later, there's hundreds of thousands killed. Right? There's not going to be enough dirt for them. Each of them have a handful of Samaria. That's how, what's going to be left of you. And for the first time that we have any recorded in history of Ahab in the Bible, his reply, it's kind of an old saying, was, and the king of Israel answered and said, let not him that girdeth on his armor boast himself as he that putteth it off. ESV is, tell him, let not him who straps on his armor boast himself as he who takes it off. What's that mean? What image do you see? Who's doing the boasting? Ben-Hadad said, I'm going to come in and take you off. And he says, don't be boasting putting your armor on with the same boast of the one who just taken it off because he won. What's a modern vernacular? Well, it's not modern anymore. It's, you know, a century old. But what do we tell our kids? Don't count your chickens before they hatch. Don't count on something that you are not sure of. Right, right. But still, you know, did you see the swear that Ben-Hadad used? Whatever is going to, if it doesn't happen, let it happen to me. Right? And we're going to find out it does. Don't swear in front of God if you don't mean it. But don't count your chickens. That's the title of our lesson today that Doug had in our outline was, let not him that girdeth on his armor boast about it, just like somebody that has already won it. Right? And it came to pass that when Ben-Hadad heard this message, he was drinking, and his kings were with him, and in the pavilions that he had said to his servants, set yourself in array. And they set themselves in array against the city. What's the modern equivalent of set yourself in array? Lock and load. Navy, we turned on the klaxons and yelled battle stations, right? Get set. So here's all the great commanders of Ben-Hadad, and what have they been doing? Remember this, they've been in a siege for how many years, we don't know. Or, you know, it's been a while because Ahab's already given up. What do you do in a siege? What's an army do in a siege? Right? Might have had a few skirmishes. You might send some scouts out. And what happens to an army when it waits? If an army doesn't have anything to do, what happens? Morale goes down. Soldiers have got to find something to do. If the commanders are sitting around in their tents drinking and getting drunk, what do you think the soldiers are doing? Right? Lead by example. Right. I saw a comment about talked about the being in their pavilions. We think of the park pavilion, you know, a little round. Well, it says that word comes from the word butterfly. And it's used to describe the tents that they use, you know. So if you think of the tent that a king would have out on the battlefield, he's not going to have the pup tent, right? He's not going to be out there in the dirt. He's going to be in this big, huge, and there's 32 of these guys. Can you imagine what these tents looked like all around, if each of them had their own? And they painted them. So you can see this image of butterflies laying out there on this desert, or up in the hills, or wherever they are around Samaria. And that's why where the word pavilion comes from. So remember, something to remember when you're out in the park again. Set yourselves in array. So, the elders of the city were able to stand up against Ben-Hadad. Ahab wasn't. He got pushed that direction, right? So he didn't do it on his own. And back to Doug's question there earlier. Do we see how bad Ahab is? That when he says, send me all your best wives, or all your wives, all your goods, all your children, everything. Because remember, once a king gets taken captive, everything belongs to the captor. Right? The captive gives it all up. Jezebel's in the same shape now. She's one of the wives. Now, was she one of the best wives? She was the head wife, according to earlier. Right? He listened to her more than anybody else. But all at once, can you imagine her when she finds out her husband has just said, I'm going to send you all my wives to this foreigner? Now remember, she was a Phoenician, so she's up from Sidon area, almost straight across from Damascus. So she wasn't a Jew to begin with. She was way up there, and they all followed Baal. So they were kind of intermingled, Phoenicians, Assyrians, maybe some of the kings that Ben-Hadad had with him were from that same area. So maybe she wasn't too scared, but still the idea that here's this powerful woman is now just being treated like a slave. Has no hope. Doesn't know what's going to happen next. And her husband, that she had propped up for all these years, just turned her over. I'm sure she was not in very good mood. Did you have anything else on that, Doug? I know you had studied this ready for
it. It was a criteria for the best.
Right, yeah. Where do you say? How many wives did he have? And which ones were the best ones? Yeah, who made that decision? Maybe they all got sent over and Ben-Hadad gets to choose which ones, you know. So. But just get them all over there. So as we get ready for this battle, and behold, a prophet came near to Ahab, king of Israel, and said, thus saith Jehovah. Okay. Who's this prophet? We don't know. There are some writings of other Jewish writers that in a couple more verses, we're going to see another prophet appear. I can't say his name. Micaiah, yeah, whatever. Yeah, that they say that may be who this is because his name appears later. But it doesn't matter. It's another prophet of God because remember, how many prophets did God tell Elijah he had that had not bowed a knee to Baal? 7,000. He's just one of the 7,000. Remember that number, though. So they came to Ahab and said, thus saith the Lord. Think Ahab is going to listen to this prophet? He didn't listen to Elijah. Hast thou seen all this great multitude? Hey, have you looked out the window here lately and seen what's around you? They're arrayed, ready for battle. Do you see them out there? Kind of mocking him, isn't he? Behold, I will deliver it into thy hands this day. And thou shalt know that I am Jehovah. Because what's Ahab going to do about it? He can't. There's not a thing he can do about this battle. And Ahab said, by whom? Who's going to do this? Who's going to do it? And he says, thus saith Jehovah, by the young men of the princes of the province. the young men of the princes of the province. EIV says, the servants of the governors of the districts. Okay, so that's where I got the idea that, you know, he has access outside of the city walls, it seems like, because he's pulling these young men from all over. Another thing was pointed out is the word for that young man. Is Hebrew N-A, squiggly A-R, not N-A-R, whatever. Guess who's used that description in the Old Testament earlier? Who was a young man that God called? David. Same word. The only difference is it was plural, whatever the plural is in this text, and David was a singular. But that young man, how old was David? You know, he wasn't in military age, right? He was not trained to be in the military. He was still taking care of the goats and the sheep and whatever. So all these young men that are coming aren't, as some commentators said, you know, the house guards or the people that, you know, that took care of everything. This is young men that had no military training are going to lead the fight against this multitude. Who's that sound like? David and Goliath? Right? God's using that same image over and over again. Who else do we have story of that faced a mighty army with a few young men?
Gideon.
Same concept. So over and over and over, see this happening. God takes what is impossible and turns the results into a miraculous, you know, complete destruction of an enemy. Why would God do that for Ahab and Israel? They had been, you know, mocking him and idol worship for all these years and everything else. Why would God do this for Ahab? To prove that I am Jehovah. You get another chance. Elijah had given up on him. It's enough. God says, I'm going to give you another chance. God's that God of second chances we all hope we have, right? Because none of us are perfect. All of us fail. All of us need second and third and fourth and fifth chances. And God provides it as long as we're alive and as long as Jesus hasn't come back. Yeah.
In chapter 18, after the big showdown on Mount Carmel, we see the people saying, you know, the Lord is God. He is God. Probably Ahab wasn't yet convinced of that. He went home to Jezebel after her prophets were killed. And now God is trying to show himself to Ahab, that he is, the people get it.
Yeah.
Obeyed Ahab.
Right. Over and over and over again, yeah. So this is going to be done by the young men of the princes of the province. You are. You, Ahab, the Israelites are going to go out and charge against this multitude. They're not going to wait around here anymore and be besieged inside of the city. Right? We're going to do it. You're going to do it. Israel's going to do it. And he answered, thou, and he mustered the young men of the princes of the province, and there were 232. How many did Gideon have? 300. About the same. Untrained young men, full of ambition, right? Ignorant enough to not know what's going to happen. Sounds like the army, right?
There were also 32 kings arrayed against them. You've got 232
right.
Governors.
Yep. So, and he mustered all the people, and after them he mustered all the people, even all the children of Israel. So everybody he could get together to fight was 7,000. Coincidence that there were 7,000 people that had not bowed to Baal for Elijah's number, and 7,000 of Israelites available to fight besides the 232 young men? Israel really declined in the last few years, hadn't they? There was nothing left. 7,000, though, is that a special number in the Bible? What's the first number? Seven. Isn't that a perfect number? How many times do we see seven throughout the Bible? Then you multiply it by 1,000. So was there exactly 7,000? Or is that just a large, that's how large of a contrast you want to see. There's a big bunch of Israelites, not really, compared to the multitude that they're going to be fighting. God's going to take care of it. So his strategy, the divine strategy, is going to win the day. And they went out at noon. But Ben-Hadad was drinking himself drunk in the pavilions. Still drinking. You know, this is the next day or so. How long did it take him to number all the people and get all these provinces together and all these princes together? We don't know. But they got together. They went out at noon. Ben-Hadad and all his kings were that helped him were drunk. And young men of the princes of the province went out first, and Ben-Hadad sent out, and they told him, saying, "There are men coming out from Samaria." Here comes a group of men. And he said, "Whether they come out for peace, take them alive, or whether they come out for war, take them alive." So those went out of the city, the young men of the princes of the province, and the army which followed them, and they slew every one his man. And the Syrians fled, and Israel pursued them, and Ben-Hadad escaped on a horse with horsemen. And the king of Israel went out and smote the horses and chariots and slew the Syrians with a great slaughter. Kind of the same story, right? Over again. But do you see God's providence in this? Ben-Hadad's drunk, so he tells his people, "Here's a small group of people coming out. You know, if they want to fight, I don't want you to kill them. I want you to bring them here. If they're coming for peace, they're going to be ambassadors. I want you to bring them here too, because we're going to have fun with them." Because I don't think he was the kind of guy that treated his enemies very well. Yeah.
With Gideon, it was that night. There were 300 of them against a whole valley full of Midianites, and they used trumpets, jars and torches,
yeah,
not real weapons, and basically the Midianites fought each other,
yeah,
slaughtered each other. This is done at noon,
right, in broad daylight,
in the very center of the day when the sun's the brightest,
right.
God is showing that we're going to give you a victory, and it's you with small numbers that's going to take down this large
number. I am the Oba.
To Ben-Hadad. Did you also see some of Ben-Hadad's problems? He sends his group out to capture this little band that was coming at him. And he says, "Bring them, if they want to fight, bring them in alive. Not dead or alive, I want you to bring them in alive." So here's his army, whatever division or whatever went out to face these men with the law from the king, don't kill them. So when they start swinging swords, these young men start swinging what swords they had, even though they weren't experienced and they were killing them, who's going to fight back? Because if you go against the king's rule, what happens? You're dead. So they go out not prepared to fight. And they get slaughtered. And Israel, that 7,000, keeps slaughtering them. And, you know, the panic ensues and they chase them off. And Ben-Hadad happens to find somebody that's not quite as drunk as he is to get him on a horse and get him out of there and head back to Damascus. He escapes. End of story, right? No. That did say, you know, the king of Israel smote the horses and chariots. And most scholars and people are saying that really didn't kill the horses and top of the chariots. It was they smote the warriors that rode the chariots and captured those. And some verses captured the horses and chariots and slew the men. But that way, guess what Israel has in their 7,000 men now? A bunch of chariots and horses. God gave them weapons. Remember, this is chariots and horses then are the tanks and the planes of today's age. Something that was fast, something that could move, something that could barrel down through the middle of a group of men and just take them out. But then the prophet came near the Lord of kings of Israel and said to him, "Go strengthen thyself and mark and see what thou dost, for at the return of the year the king of Syria will come up against you again." In the spring, when the rains are over, he's going to come back. Get ready. Prepare the best you can. Get ready for all this. Again, God's helping Ahab. Why? And then the kings of the servants of the king of Syria said unto him, to Ben-Hadad's group, "Their God is a God of the hills." Where's Samaria? Set on a hill. That's why they built it up there. It was a fortress. That's why they couldn't just take the city quickly. But servants or his people around the king of Syria said, "Their God, little g, is the king of the hills." Yeah. "Therefore, they are stronger than us. Let us fight against them in the plains, where we surely will be stronger than they, and do this and take the kings away. Get rid of those 32 kings that sit around and drink with you. Take them away, every man out of his place, and put captains in their place, in their room." Take a military man and take charge of those armies of those 32 kings. Keep the drunks away from you. You have enough trouble with getting drunk. "And put captains in their place, and number thee an army like the army that thou just lost, horse for horse, chariot for chariot, and we will fight against them in the plains, and we will surely be stronger than they." And they hearkened unto their voice and did so. Where's the chariot had the best advantage? Nice flat ground. Okay? Because when you're trying to charge up a hill, you've got the person on top has the advantage. So here's the plan. Both sides are planning for the springtime. Here comes the. And sure enough, it came to pass at the return of the year that Ben-Hadad mustered the Syrians and went up to Aphek, another little city. We're not sure exactly where, because there was a couple of places named Aphek, but it was a flat plain. And the children of Israel mustered and went up against them. The children of Israel encamped before them like two little flocks of kids or goats. That's how big the army came back from Syria. That the army of Israel looked like two little pastures of goats. Or even this, the King James says, kids, little goats. not even Billy Goat Gruff, just little guys. But the Syrians filled the country. Not the valley, the country. And a man of God came near and spake unto the king of Israel and said, "Because the Syrians have said, Jehovah is a God of the hills, but he is not a God of the valleys. Therefore, I will deliver all this great multitude to thy hand, and ye shall know that I am Jehovah."
But it sounds like Ahab got that
first. Yeah, he's driving that point in, right? You're going to know it. They're going to know it. They insulted me. You didn't get upset because they insulted me. God knew their plan. And they encamped one against another for 7 days. And so it was in the seventh day that the battle was joined. And the children of Israel slew the Syrians 100,000 footmen in one day. Those two little groups of sheep slay 100,000 people in one day. But the rest fled to Aphek into the city, and the wall fell upon 20 and 7,000 of the men that were left. And Ben-Hadad fled and came into the city, into the inner chamber. So did 27,000 people die because the walls fell down? Or terminology back then, when you took a city and you tore the walls down, you captured that city. And they died because they were in the city. Ben-Hadad then goes and they come out and he says, he sends servants out. You know, he's got the sackcloth on. He's got the ropes around their necks or on their heads, it says, showing that he's given up. And he says, send this to Ahab that I'm coming out. Know that I am Jehovah. And the servants of Ben-Hadad had the ropes on their heads, came to the king of Israel and said, the servant, thy servant, Ben-Hadad. Remember before it was Ahab being the, my servant Ben-Hadad, let me live. The servant of Ben-Hadad saith, I pray, let me live. And he said, is he yet alive? Is he still alive? He's my brother. How can Ahab and Ben-Hadad, that been mourning all this time, be brothers? They weren't related in flesh. Who's their God? Baal. Even then, after all this, Ahab still is clutching onto his false God. Doesn't know God is God. And said, now the men observed diligently and hasted to catch whether it was on his mind. He said, thy brother Ben-Hadad. Then he said, go ye bring him. And Ben-Hadad came forth, and they caused him to come into the chariot. And he said, the cities which were my father's, I'm going to give back, you know, and all this other stuff. You can come to Damascus and set up trade with us, and we'll take care of everything. And Ben-Hadad is let go. Ahab turns him loose. And God sent a certain man of sons, king, follow the word of Jehovah, saying, smite thee, I pray me. And the man, so anyway, a prophet gets injured, makes another man injure him so he could be sitting there hurt. Tells him that I had a prisoner and I let him escape, and they told me I was going to have to pay a huge amount or they're going to kill me. And the king says, they're right, you should die. And he takes off the camouflage and they look at him, and Ahab recognizes him as a prophet again. And he says, what you just accused me of and gave me a sentence of, that's what God's going to do to you. You let this evil man. So why did God do all this for Ahab? One thought was, what happened to Syria after this? They're no more. They get captured. The Assyrians take over. The next kingdom comes down. But what did it protect by not allowing Syria to take Israel? Where would they go next? Judah. They would have been nothing between them and Judah, which is even smaller than Israel. God protect his chosen people by allowing Israel to take care of Syria. God's promise was there. He protects what he wants. He protected the seed. He protected the lineage of Jesus by having Israel take care of Syria. Never doubt our God. He's got a plan for us. We just need to follow it. Thank you.